Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we pride ourselves in being able to present to you from time to time is our first guest. His name is Robert Spencer. He is the director of an extraordinarily important online resource, jihadwatch.org, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Robert contributes mightily, not only through his voluminous published books, some 23 of them, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam. He is also an essayist with PJ Magazine and Front Page Magazine, and a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, I'm very pleased to say. Robert, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back, sir.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
Let's start with Afghanistan. The Trump administration held consultations, negotiations, dialogue, whatever you want to call it, with representatives of the Taliban in Qatar yesterday, I believe, and came away saying that they were professional and productive. I'm not quite sure what any of that means in the case of the Taliban, but I suspect it's not good. What do you anticipate, Robert, is the prospect for having serious negotiations with a group like the Taliban about curbing terrorism, promoting human rights, the ability of women and girls to participate in Afghan society and the like?
It's a useless exercise, Frank. It's an exercise in futility, and it's really just a pretext to start the American money flowing to the Taliban, essentially, because even though the State Department has given assurances that it will give humanitarian aid not to the Taliban but to other elements in Afghanistan, that's really not practical. The Taliban is in control of the country, and so it's not as if there's some other group that has sufficient power stand the Taliban if the Taliban comes and says, you've received American aid, hand it over. And so in the first place, it's completely realistic in that way. It's also realistic in the sense that the State Department is working on the assumption, a very longstanding and cherished assumption in Washington, that we can essentially buy friends, that the United States can win over allies or pacify antagonists by our bank book. This is certainly not true in the case of Afghanistan and the Taliban, if it was ever true anywhere, which is not at all certain. The Taliban operates according to the principles of Sharia and is not going to be swayed by that to become friendly to the United States by American money. As a matter of fact, according to Sharia, it is the responsibility of non-Muslims to pay for the upkeep of Muslims, to pay the jizya as specified in the Quran and accept the hegemony of the Muslims. So when the Taliban sees the United States ready to hand over millions of dollars to it, it only sees it as its due. This is what infidel regimes are supposed to do.
Yeah, it's called submission, is it not?
Yes. And it has nothing to do with any kind of reciprocal action on the part of the Taliban. They don't consider that they have any responsibility to reciprocate our friendliness.
Nor will they. And this brings us to the question of the advisability of bringing large numbers of unvetted people from Afghanistan into this country. It seems, Robert Spencer, the vast majority of them having not qualified for that privilege, and I emphasize the word privilege, of being able to come here, let alone to receive the myriad benefits that are automatically conferred upon people with refugee status in our country. But we're hearing in addition that numbers are continuing to swell. I was told on Breitbart's radio show this morning that 1,000 more Afghans are being brought to the United States every day. And I, again, assume that the vetting process has not improved markedly from what it was when we were simply loading them onto planes and exporting them from Afghanistan. What are your thoughts about the possibilities that something might go dreadfully wrong in American communities in which such people are now being deposited by so-called refugee resettlement organizations?
What would be a surprise, Frank, is if there were not violent disruptions and cultural disruptions in American communities caused by Afghan migrants. The problem here is that you're talking about a society that, in the first place, has been for decades now dominated by the Taliban, one jihad group, which is quite friendly with another jihad group, Al-Qaeda, and which is has a sort of friendly rivalry with a third jihad group, ISIS. All three of them have a presence in Afghanistan. And so what is the likelihood that we brought over some jihadis along with all these unvetted people who have come from Afghanistan into the United States in recent weeks? It's virtually 100% because you're talking about a jihadi hotspot. And also there's the cultural aspect. And there was a recent incident, there have been actually a series of recent incidents in England at what was formerly a very luxurious resort hotel, the Grand Hotel in Scarborough on the Yorkshire coast. This is a place that the British government has chosen to resettle a lot of the Afghan refugees, at least temporarily, to house them in this hotel. And hotel guests have been confronted with all sorts of strange and sometimes quite repulsive incidents, including the fact that the Afghan refugees are not familiar with Western toilets and don't know how to use them, and leave a terrible mess in these restrooms. This is just one small example of the cultural dislocation and disharmony that is going to be brought to our societies by these refugees. But nobody is paying any attention to this, because in the Scarborough Hotel, as well as in the United States, in the public square, elsewhere, it's always just dismissed as racism. Anybody who has any concerns about these migrants is just a racist. And that's it. And it shuts down all the discussion.
It's one thing for cultural norms to be a problem, Robert. And I think that's not altogether surprising, given that much of Afghanistan is, well, in the pre-industrial age, shall we say, if not the Middle Ages. Presumably, those traits about modern hygiene and toilet facilities and so on can be taught to them. Assuming they're willing to be taught. Much more worrying is that other bit, that you have at least some number of these individuals imbued with their Sharia traditions. And that will be, I fear, I've called it a ticking time bomb for communities across this country, quite possibly. Which brings me back to a topic that you addressed at PJ Media recently, which was an essay in what you called a lefty rag about actually what modern jihad reflects, not Islamic traditions at all, but it's neoliberal capitalism that is the cause. What are we to make of things like this, Robert, and sort of the more general lack of attention to the prospect of jihadism in our country that, might be brought to us by Afghan refugees or might simply be inspired by our humiliating defeat at Joe Biden's hands in Afghanistan?
You know, this article appeared in Counterpunch, which is indeed a lefty rag, a far-left socialist organ in America. And yet, of course, as I point out actually in the article, it's important to pay attention to what such people are saying, because they're not on the lunatic fringe anymore. They're in the corridors of power. And consequently, what Counterpunch says is worth noticing. In any case, they just...
And when you say the corridors of power, what exactly do you mean by that, Robert?
Well, I'm talking about in the Biden administration, which many people have noted is essentially under the control of the farthest left elements of the Democratic Party, left elements which actually make no secret of being socialist. Bernie Sanders, who is a self-proclaimed socialist, as well as the notorious squad of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who I believe has also acknowledged being a socialist, or if in any case, even if she hasn't, she quite obviously is one. And her allies, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, Presley and Cori Bush, among others. They are the real power in the Democratic Party today, and they are, for the most part, open socialists, or as quite obviously socialists. If not, they're not open about it, yes. So this is one of, this counterpunch article is one of many that simply ignores and denies and tries to explain away the phenomenon of jihad. This is something that really elements across the board have been doing since 9/11 and before that, conservatives as well as leftists. This is seems to be a threat that people just are not disposed to acknowledge. And meanwhile, under the cover of that willful ignorance, this threat continues to expand.
It does indeed. Metastasize is the word that comes to my mind. And Robert, in your collected works, not just what you do day by day at jihadwatch.org, but in your myriad books on jihad and Sharia and the teachings of Muhammad and the rest, you've really made the case, I believe, in an airtight fashion that what we're dealing with in the authoritative rendering of Islam, again, not as practiced by all Muslims by any means, but the authorities of the faith exhort their followers, their faithful adherents, to engage in these kinds of jihadist activities. And it is willful blindness, perhaps, on our part. It is suicidal, I think, in practice. And it must be challenged. And I salute you for doing so, and doing so so authoritatively and articulately and courageously as well. Let me turn lastly to Iran. Here we have again the Biden administration assiduously, aggressively seeking, well, to submit to the Iranians. Specifically, they're trying to induce the Iranians to re-enter some sort of agreement with us, a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA 2.0, or something. And they seem to be determined to make concessions right and left to obtain that agreement, including taking companies involved in making missiles with which to deliver nuclear warheads to Iran's enemies, which of course includes Israel and us. There's also, it seems, turning a blind eye to various provocative behaviors on the part of the Iranians, notably continuing to enrich uranium to near weapons grade and in quantities that would give rise very quickly to nuclear weapons capabilities. And also, at least if some of the videos that we're seeing out of Iran are to be believed, harassing, threatening our naval vessels. Talk about ground truth, if you would, with respect to Iran and the dangers associated with this kind of behavior by the Biden team.
The dangers can be summed up in the fact that the Iranians, the mullahs who rule the country, see the world in terms of strength and weakness. And that is primarily the paradigm that they use to understand pretty much every conflict. Consequently, when they see the Biden administration willing to make virtually any concession and go to any length to come to an agreement with it, they just see that as weakness to be exploited. And that's why the naval vessels have once again begun to be harassed, because the Iranian mullahs correctly see the Biden administration as weak, as not willing to retaliate, and this gives them carte blanche. It's noteworthy that there were some notorious incidents of the same kind during the Obama administration, but they stopped for 4 years during the Trump administration because the Iranians respected that there was a president who was strong and would clearly strike back if they struck. And when they did intend actions against Americans in Iraq, then Trump took out Soleimani, the Iranian commander who was masterminding these attacks. And there were all sorts of predictions that this would lead to a terrible escalation and maybe even to war. But actually, it led to quiet because the Iranians respect strength. And they exploit weakness, and that's what we're seeing in the world today.
Respecting strength, of course, was at the core of my old boss Ronald Reagan's famous philosophy of peace through strength. And it's the one approach to international affairs, I believe, that actually has a record of success. And every time we've tried pursuit of peace through accommodation, appeasement, outright weakness on the part of the United States, it has ended badly. And Robert Spencer, I appreciate, as always, your clarity on such points and the reality that whether we choose to acknowledge them or not, enemies determined to destroy us, whether it's in the name of their God or in the name of their party, cannot be ignored when they not only engage in such rhetoric, but also accompany it with increasing indications that they seek to act aggressively against us as well. Thank you, my friend, for your time today and for the great work that you do at jihadwatch.org. I hope everyone has it bookmarked and is checking it religiously, as I try to do. And we appreciate our visits with you and look forward to doing one again soon. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us, if you will, in the near future, and stay well in the meantime. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis. We'll take stock with him on what's going on with Southwest Airlines and Taiwan and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say also back is Sam Faddis, Charles Sam Faddis, patriot of the First Order, a man who has served his country in the uniform of the United States Army and without a uniform as a clandestine services officer of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is an author of a number of really important books, including a nonfiction work entitled Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is also profoundly prodigious and productive contributor to Driving Force of fabulous online resource called And Magazine. You can find it at andmagazine.com. He's also a valued member of our Committee on the Present Danger China and a cherished colleague. It's always great to have him on the show. Welcome back, Sam.
Thank you for having me, Frank, as always.
You've been writing at And Magazine and published others who have as well about the state of the vaccinations and the impact that mandates for everybody to take them, for COVID-19, that is, are having on both our society in general and specifically military personnel and units and key parts of our business infrastructure, particularly in the transportation space. Let's start with something that you published from Dr. Stephen Hatfield, who is a renowned, sometimes controversial, but I think extremely impressive authority on virology and related matters. Tell us about his assessment of the state of the disease, COVID-19, first and foremost, and the relevance that that has to the efficacy of the vaccines that are currently available to us.
Right. Well, I think the first thing that people need to understand about Dr. Hatfield is that, as you said, he's a renowned virologist. He worked at Fort Detrick, so at the heart of our biodefense programs for a number of years. And he literally wrote the book on pandemic defense, sort of the game plan, the official game plan for the U.S. government on how we would respond to a pandemic, and has been focused sort of on coronaviruses, amongst other diseases, for a very long time. So while COVID kind of came as a, you know, out of the blue for most of us, Hatfield's been looking at this for a very long time. So, you know, he's a guy, he knows of what he speaks. He has been studying this specific problem for a very long time, and this family of diseases, if you will, for a very long time. And in essence, what Dr. Hatfield says, who by this point I have talked to on many occasions, is that what you have is you have a virus that mutates so rapidly and so completely that, in effect, what you are dealing with now, X number of months into this pandemic, you ought to consider almost a completely new disease. I mean, it's sort of the simplest conceptual way. That's not his exact verbiage, but I think for the lay person, that's the best way to look at it. So what you are now doing with vaccines, before we even get into side effects and all kinds of other issues, is you are forcing people or contemplating forcing people to take vaccines, which, as he puts it, are to vaccinate you against a disease that is now extinct. The original variety of the virus, the original strain, effectively no longer exists. And the virus, and the, therefore this, and this vaccine essentially has no efficacy whatsoever against the strains like Delta and then the Mu strain and all those that are coming. So
is that right? Because, you know, we're being told endlessly in the midst of the continuing onslaught of the Delta virus, to say nothing of Lambda or whatever's coming next, that everybody has to be vaccinated because it is effective, at least in reducing the severity of the disease, preventing you from going into the hospital, certainly from dying. And you're saying he is of the opinion that it is essentially ineffective against Delta?
That's exactly what I'm saying. In fact, literally, when I spoke, as I say, I've spoken to Dr. Hatfield on any number of occasions, but when I spoke to him in advance of writing the article that you're referencing, literally, when I asked him, okay, so, you know, sort of bring me up to date, where's the status, what's going on with these vaccines, and essentially the first words out of his mouth were, we are forcing people to take a vaccine against a disease that is now extinct. Against a virus that is now extinct. So the idea that you're having...
And that is the original version, and I guess the two first variants, A and B, Alpha, Bravo, I guess. Is that what he's referring to specifically?
Correct. So you have developed a vaccine. Again, there are a whole bunch of other questions, but at best, you have developed a vaccine against a disease that no longer exists. And there are... The next thing that Hatfield says, again, this is a guy who literally wrote our plan for how to respond to a pandemic, which I should add, by the way, the U.S. government then completely disregarded. All of the planning that Hatfield laid on and how to handle this was simply tossed out the window. So he is not the architect of lockdowns or masks or anything else. But he says, look, and here's the implication, the what you really need to understand. You cannot vaccinate your way out of the pandemic because the virus will continue to mutate, obviously, at this pace. And your development time for new vaccines is greater than the time it takes the virus to change. So you, no matter what resources you devote, you will always be developing vaccines to a strain that is vanishing at a minimum and chasing your tail, if you will. So he says very explicitly, and a number of other people have said this, by the way, the European WHO director has said this, the British have said this, it is not possible to vaccinate your way out of this. And another implication here, and this is an issue on which Hatfield is also crystal clear, there is no question, in his opinion, that your natural immunity from having been exposed to the disease is not just equivalent to what you get from a vaccination. It is greatly superior. When your body develops a natural immunity to the disease, I'm not the guy to get down in the weeds in the science, but your body then acquires an immunity, essentially a capacity to recognize future strains and attack them and prevents you from getting having a whole new case of COVID. The vaccination does not do that. The vaccination is, if you will, much more specific. Therefore, if your body sees the alpha strain, it will respond to it. It doesn't recognize Delta. It doesn't recognize Lambda. It doesn't recognize any of these others. And therefore, what we're in effect doing is we're preventing people from ever acquiring natural immunity, and therefore we're never getting out of the crisis phase of the pandemic. What he says very clearly is we are, by focusing on vaccination, ensuring that we remain in this initial crisis phase of the pandemic, sort of in perpetuity.
Just coming back to something you mentioned a moment ago, Sam, Dr. Hatfield's prescription, if I can use that expression, for dealing with a pandemic was thrown out. I guess that would have been during the Trump presidency. Does he know who, and has he talked about who is responsible for ignoring that in favor of, what certainly seems to be the Chinese playbook for the lockdowns and societal disruptions?
Well, he's written pretty extensively on that. And I mean, you can find that online, and he's named some names. I mean, and he absolutely says that this entire idea of lockdowns originated in communist China. It had never been contemplated. It was never part of the playbook in the West. Nobody ever discussed it. It's never been used previously in history. Quarantining sick people is one thing. Locking down healthy people and masking them is essentially unprecedented. And yes, it came, the communist China, you know, in Xi Jinping imposed this on his people. And then our folks in public health here picked it up and began to impose it.
With him strongly urging, as I recall, the adoption of the Chinese model. So it wasn't as though this was something that wasn't both, you know, sort of adopted initially in China, but also they were indifferent to whether it was adopted by others. They were very, very much pressing, I think, through the WHO and others, if I'm not mistaken, this course of action.
Without question. And that's exactly what Hatfield says.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, to be fair, Hatfield also says, listen, along with the lockdowns, we decided we were going to essentially abandon early treatment, which we've never done with any disease before, and put all of our money on vaccination. And he's pretty scathing in saying the folks that came in and took charge of the effort came sort of out of the big pharmaceutical industry. And because there are dollar signs flashing in front of everybody's eyes, if you can take this in the direction of vaccination, you're going to make a boatload of money. So you've got money and control issues. And the next thing you know, Hatfield went from being sitting in the White House, where he had been summoned to be sort of the, you know, take the principal advisor on how to respond to the pandemic, to being shown the door and told to go away.
And Fauci was elevated to that position, I guess.
Exactly.
What you've just described in terms of the decision not to treat people, but to try to prevent them from getting the disease in the first place, was actually essential to the big pharma gambit here, was it not? Because if you had effective therapies, whether it was hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or cocktails of the two or others, you could not justify the emergency use authorization for these rather, well, shall we say, problematic vaccinations. Is that not correct?
Yeah, that's precisely correct, Frank. I mean, legally, in order to get the emergency use authorization, legally, you are required to show that there are no existing effective treatments for the disease. That is a prerequisite for you to apply for and receive an emergency use authorization. So if you acknowledge that, say, hydroxychloroquine, I'm not pushing that, I'm just using that as an example. If you accepted that hydroxychloroquine had efficacy and could be used to treat this disease, then legally you could not apply for and receive permission for an emergency use authorization, which would mean at a minimum that your vaccines, rather than being able to come to market in 6 months, would come to market in years, because that's how long it takes to go through this process. So if you look at it through that lens, and you look at the media attacks and against hydroxychloroquine and other medications, it certainly suggests that that was a concerted effort. And this is absolutely what Hadfield says without reservation. This was a deliberate, concerted effort to prevent the use of these medications. Also, by the way, we should keep in mind, things like hydroxychloroquine are now available in generic form. And so rather than being able to market a vaccine that is tremendously expensive, people would be able to treat the disease for almost nothing, as has been done in actually large portions of the world. So,
well, in fact, I had a very interesting
pull any punches on this.
Yeah, I had a very interesting interview on our television program last week with Dr. Pierre Corey, who was talking about this effectively this massive test on 240 some million people in the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh using ivermectin to treat and essentially snuff the disease in that part of that very populous country. It's an amazing tale. And one just has to ask, how many Americans needlessly lost their lives because they were not getting treatments in the interest of trying to assure that there was going to be this vaccine fast track? And Sam, we're almost out of time, and I did want to just hit you with two other questions quickly. You have written about Dr. Hatfield's findings in the context of concerns about mandates to have these vaccines imposed upon our military personnel is having a very deleterious effect on readiness, including of some of our most elite units like the Navy SEALs. Point one, and point two, that Southwest Airlines' recent difficulties, in which they had massive cancellations, was not actually a problem of weather or their hub or lack thereof infrastructure, but rather people refusing to be vaccinated. Give us just a quick response on both of those points, if you would.
Southwest pilots and other personnel are not showing up for work, and they're not doing it. And it is a job action, and it is in response to the vaccine mandate. The union constantly comes out and says there is no job action. Well, there's a reason for that, because if it's a formal job action of this type, it's actually illegal under federal law. So the union will every 24 hours announce that officially the union is staging no job action. That doesn't change the fact that individually all of these people are in fact refusing to come to work. So the union knows that, and Southwest Airlines knows that, and everybody else knows that. And
yet
like
we're
so
constantly being
news,
misinformed about it. Yeah, that's astonishing, but not uncommon these days. Okay, so how about the military, and what impact these mandates are having there?
I think you're going to see huge impact there, just like with law enforcement. I mean, there was a number thrown out the other day, 600-700 Navy SEALs that haven't gotten vaccinated. Well, you know, I won't give you an exact number of the SEAL, of the number of SEALs, but if you're talking about actual guys in SEAL teams in the Navy, and 600 or 700 of them are no longer available, well, you effectively have no SEAL teams anymore in the entire United States Navy. There's not that many of them.
And even if it's not just the numbers that are having that impact, it's the units that can't deploy without their proper complement of personnel.
100%. You just literally don't have any SEAL teams in the U.S. Navy if you actually say 700 guys are non-deployable. You just took that entire capability off the board.
And
we're
going to
see this everywhere. See,
when they're non-deployable, that's because they are no longer considered eligible to serve, or they have actually withdrawn from the service, or is it some combination of the two?
Well, the question of how it plays out, we'll see. I mean, to start with, the Navy saying they can't be deployed. After that, presumably, if you're violating a direct order to get vaccinated, then they're talking about separating 700 guys from the service. Again, this is one of many, many examples. You're talking about melting down that entire capability for the U.S. Navy. You won't have a SEAL team to send anywhere if you do that. And God knows how long it'll take you to rebuild that capability.
And that's the key point. And you've served alongside these very, very professionally highly qualified, highly trained, highly skilled individuals, Sam Faddis, in the course of your career, I know. And you have an appreciation for what that means for the national security of the United States. And sadly, It's just one example of a larger problem. I'm told the Marines are facing this as well, and I think pilots in the Air Force are similarly refusing to take the vaccinations. These are national security challenges and threats, really, of the first order, and they flow directly from this diktat from Joe Biden that everybody must take the jab, as they say. Next up, we'll speak with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles about the threat to Taiwan. Are we at the brink of war? That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and rounding up our all-star cast today is Robert Charles, a former Assistant Secretary of State who served during the George W. Bush administration as the man responsible in the department for the narcotics and law enforcement portfolio. This has been the most recent of a series of important positions he held in our government, including as a counsel in the Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He is an author of Eagles and Evergreen and a very, well, prodigious contributor to the public policy debate, notably as the spokesman of a terrific organization, the Association for Mature American Citizens. You can follow Robert Charles's work at amac.us. Bobby, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Frank. We're certainly in a time when the American public needs to be vigilant and also forward-leaning.
Amen. And leaning to what end is sort of why we're happy to have you here with us. In particular, Bobby, I wanted to just both call attention to and ask you to elaborate on some of the writing that you've been doing lately about what the Biden team is inviting in terms of aggression against Taiwan. I don't think that's overstating it at this point. And I'd like you to talk both about the stakes if China does that, and not just for the Taiwanese people, of course, but for our interest in Asia and perhaps us here at home as well, and the extent to which the administration does, in fact, seem to be clearing the way for the Chinese to act in that belligerent fashion.
Yeah, so I think, Frank, that we have often, words are cheap, and we have often talked about what might happen to Taiwan if there wasn't a more formidable American presence and leadership and awareness, basically both internally and projected, that we're going to protect that country. And the key here for people to understand is that Taiwan, in many ways, is emblematic of freedom at large, that if we lose an interest in defending freedom in Taiwan, the signal is given to the entire world for all time that we've basically given up on the notion that freedom matters. And I say that with two thoughts in mind. First, there has to be an understanding of history, and people don't really understand why we defend Taiwan. And the second is that the action required at this moment, as Taiwan ramps up, communist China ramps up pressure on Taiwan, is very simple. It is a deterrent act. We need to say, listen, back off. Because the bottom line, we need to say it in physical terms as well as in words. You know, just a very quick backdrop in terms of history, just so people understand. You know, people don't really understand in many ways what China and what Taiwan are about. A lot of people, some of your listeners do, obviously, but many who are fresh to the, particularly younger, don't necessarily. So, you know, the bottom line is that China was for thousands of years, you know, an imperial country. It was under until 1912. It was under the hand of the Qing dynasty. And after a series of back and forth and civil war, and after Japan invaded China in 1937, and then Japan lost World War II, we ended up in a position where you had the civil war writ large, which was the communists under Mao, and you had the nationalists who were freedom loving, really under Chiang Kai-shek. George C. Marshall and others tried to get to conclusion, didn't happen. Richard Nixon negotiated this thing called the Shanghai Communique, which was very ambiguous, where we had previously said that the legitimate government was Taiwan. We now end up in a position where we're legitimizing communist China. And of course, the next thing that happened is we punched tons of money into communist China. And over the decades since, we've realized that didn't liberalize China. what it did in turn is it empowered China to repress with greater power. We're now at a point where American leadership is seriously in question, and Biden has put it in question in Afghanistan, Iran, all over the world. And what is that? And by the way, hollowing out our military and demoralizing our military. And what has that done? It has really given China the idea, communist China, that they may yet be at the best point in history to take Taiwan, whether they do that militarily, economically, et cetera. And so what has really happened, October 6th, they sent in 52 military aircraft into Taiwanese airspace. That was the largest show of force on record. In the preceding days, they sent in 38 aircraft one day, 39 another, 16 another. They're truly ramping up. They're ramping up their own military, you know, revealing a stealth fighter for a carrier-based deployment, which is actually clearly stolen from us. I mean, it's the blueprints look identical. Across their mainland, they're putting in lots and lots of nuclear missile silos. So the idea is intimidation or us is what China is thinking right now. And they are intimidating Taiwan. And what we need to do is step up, stand up and say, no, freedom is not going to be just taken by a communist country in this way, and not of an ally of ours, and not Taiwan.
Back off is the way you put it, and I couldn't agree with you more. I couldn't especially more strongly endorse your analysis that we're at the cusp of something that could well have profound implications. Not perhaps just those you've described, Bobby, bad as those would be, that we've permanently abandoned our role as leader of the free world, but that we may, in the process, put ourselves in even greater jeopardy of the kind of threat to us, the dominance, the forced submission of this country that the Chinese Communist Party clearly has in mind. We talked earlier in the program about submission to Sharia supremacism. You know, the Sharia supremacists have their idea of an end state in which we are submitting to them. The communist Chinese have their own. But what's even worrying more so is they're working together, it seems, to try to accomplish that ultimate end state, different as they may have in mind what it would look like. But the main point is, this is a moment when a lot more is on the line than just the security of the people of Taiwan, important as that should be to us. And I really appreciate your clarity on this. Aren't there steps that we can take, Bobby? We've identified some in our Committee on the Present Danger China, of which you are, I'm happy to say, also a member. What is the administration doing to signal any kind of seriousness about opposing this behavior? Or what could they do, I guess, more to the point?
Yeah, so to that specific point, Frank, there are a number of things we always have historically done when we want to send a signal that you're coming up to a line you can't cross. And it isn't about announcing, as Obama did, that there was a line and then ignoring it. The reality is you have to send a carrier battle group into the Pacific. You have to spend time in public dialogue. You have to rally allies so that there are unified preparatory economic actions. You have to respond, and it sounds a little bit schoolyardish, but you have to respond tit for tat. If they fly into a location where they attempt to dominate or close off or sequester a location, you need to respond one-on-one. I mean, during the Soviet era, when bear bombers entered our airspace, we immediately scrambled fighters and escorted them out. And so the point is, you have to be responsive. And as an old diplomat once said to me, you know, when you pull your hand out of the bucket, it fills in real fast around you. Meaning, if you don't respond, if you don't deter, then the party that's aggressive pushes the line further to see how far they can go. You know, my biggest concern, Frank, is really a dual concern. And this is before we talk about China's influence inside the United States or the rise of Sharia law or other threats to the United States. Ideologically as well as physically. One is that we could have an accidental war, because if you give the signal that you're not interested, yet you know that as a matter of international imperative and national security imperative, you will have to respond, then you're setting up the failure. And that's an accidental one. The second one is that you could be looking at 1939 all over again in the sense that China wants domination. They certainly said that at their annual conference, which is rather remarkable to start speaking about, you know, the demise of the West and global dominance of communism. But if that's where they went, I am fearful that we look right now more like France in 1939, imagining that our hollowed out military is the Maginot Line that, of course, crumbled right away. We have to be strong in our own minds, in our own hearts. As Shakespeare said, you know, if our minds are strong, then we're ready. But we're not ready right now. And this administration is signaling that we're not ready. So that's my biggest concern.
Mine too. And I think the sort of steps that we've recommended at the Committee on the Present Danger China, which our audience can find at presentdangerchina.org, are overdue and urgently needed to make plain, as you've said, Bobby, that China must back off on this threat to Taiwan. Let me turn to another topic. With your time in senior posts in the United States government, Bobby, your experience as a lawyer, as a champion for freedom, there was a very important essay in the Wall Street Journal, just published by James Sensenbrenner, now a former member of Congress, longtime member of Congress, former chairman of the Judiciary Committee, principal author of the Patriot Act while he was there in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, a controversial piece of legislation. But he particularly went after the Biden administration for invoking the Patriot Act as a pretext and legal basis upon which to designate or at least threaten to brand parents in school board meetings with being identified as potential domestic terrorists. And I just wanted to get you to respond to something he said about this now pattern of behavior, really, but this Merrick Garland letter, the Attorney General's memo indicating to the Justice Department and FBI that they should treat these parents in this fashion, was denounced by Jim Sensenbrenner as, quote, "the Biden administration's unparalleled effort to transform federal laws and agencies into instruments of domestic political repression," unquote. Do you see it that way?
Frank, I try very hard to be someone who looks at things not in an understated way, but from every angle before reaching a conclusion. And I have to tell you that the pebbles are piling up on the end that really looks like a lot of this is intentional. And intentional in the direction of political repression of speech and of actions that would contravene this leftist sort of drive now. And, you know, so from a legal perspective, the idea of using that kind of draconian federal act to intercede at a very local level to chill speech is, you know, the first thing you say right off the bat is that is inapt, that is inappropriate, that is a misapplication of federal law. The second thing, though, that you say is that this is, you immediately ask, well, is this intentional? And I'm going to give you three data points. One is that Merrick Garland, if you go back, worked in a Justice Department that knows very well that this is inappropriate. So he's doing this with intention. He knows that the history of the law is that you don't apply this kind of law to that kind of situation. The second thing I'm going to say is that this really was precipitated. You can just tell this was precipitated. They claim that it was precipitated by a letter from the National Association of School Boards. Well, let's go back. I did some research. Let's go back and figure out what that really is all about. What that really is all about is the Department of Justice wanted to do this, and they went to that association and said, send us a letter. And who is the head of that association? A diehard Democrat with a history of doing this kind of thing. And does that represent where most Americans are? Absolutely not. Most school boards? Absolutely not. And then you go to the big city school boards. There's a real difference between, this is the third point. You go to there's a huge difference between local school boards in most of America, where most of this is being objected to, and the school boards on the left and right coast of the United States, which are dominated by the unions. The people that get pushed into school boards from Montgomery County, Maryland to California are typically aligned with the very powerful left-leaning teachers' unions. But that's not what it's like in 48 of the probably states. It's not like that in most of them. Maybe 48 is too many. It's not like that in 40 of the states where school boards, and I grew up in Maine, are generally populated by people who step up for a short period of time at the behest of other parents to do their job before they then check out and go back and become a parent again. And the truth be told here is they are trying to pressure the normal everyday Americans by calling them domestic terrorists. That's what that law is about. So it's utterly, utterly and completely inept. And I'm afraid it's being done with intent. So Sensenbrenner doesn't speak out that often on this kind of thing, but boy, he's right on this. And he's coming down hard like a hammer because he's saying, wake up people, when you use federal laws to coerce and to chill speech and to potentially punish as domestic terrorists, parents who are saying, don't put CRT in my schools, you have really done something that's out of line.
Well, and ominous in the extreme, because it won't stop there, that's for sure. And I completely agree with you, Bobby Charles, that what we're looking at is part of an intentional program. This is not a one-off. This is systematic. It is not having, you know, unfortunate or untoward consequences. It is a wrecking operation, full on. And I think what we must do in response is, as former Congressman Sensenbrenner says, bring it to a screeching halt, in this case specifically, but also the trajectory that we're on. I know you're a man with long experience in the federal court system, as well as in the civilian side of various agencies, but this was a godsend in a way. We've learned the nature of Merrick Garland, and we were spared. I'm not often complimentary of Mitch McConnell, but I think in this case, when he was the majority leader of the Senate, his role in blocking Merrick Garland from being appointed to the Supreme Court was a signal achievement. And heaven have helped us if we had a man who's proving to be as radical as he is on the court in this environment, especially. So
I was just going to close by saying, you know, I think we need to be very much on guard for Merrick Garland, because they've just filed a brief to try to reverse the Fifth Circuit's blocking of, essentially he is going to try to, I think, subvert any decision that's made by the Supreme Court that reverses Roe v. Wade. I think he's very anti-Second Amendment. I think he's obviously demonstrating that he's anti-First Amendment. So I just think we have to be very on guard about this Attorney General. He's pushing the envelope, and I think Americans need to push back.
Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Finally, a prominent politician has explicitly denounced, quote, the Biden administration's unparalleled effort to transform federal laws and agencies into instruments of domestic political repression, unquote. Unfortunately, while former Wisconsin Representative James Sensenbrenner has laudably called in the Wall Street Journal for Congress to block the latest example of such abuse, namely Attorney General Merrick Garland's memorandum ordering the Justice Department and FBI to treat parents who express opposition to school boards' racist indoctrination of their children as domestic terrorists, he is no longer in a position to compel such redress. It now falls to patriots who are in Congress and their supporters to embrace Mr. Sensenbrenner's call to, quote, demand the immediate withdrawal of the school board memorandum, bar the appropriation of funds to implement it, and directly challenge the administration's efforts to misuse federal laws to silence political opposition, unquote. This is Frank Gaffney.